In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy on Salem radio show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on state government.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
It's not just a show. It's self-defense. And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
And thank you, everyone, for joining us on the I Spy on Salem radio show, where every week we try to get a little more intelligence on what goes on in state government. Today, wow, we are doing a story that follows right along with last week's Basic and American Rights series, which focused on property rights and land use. This week, we're following up on a story idea that Carla K. Edwards put us onto about the dam removal on the Klamath River. Personally, I think it's a perfect example of the environmental nonsense put into action by the far left. It's about stopping people from using their land, or at least not in a way that conflicts with the left's perceived worldview. It's about stakeholder theory run amok. It's about changing existing energy sources to less efficient and more costly sources, such as solar and wind, which just happens to be industries run by their political cronies. And it's about anti-business, all done under the cloak of saving the earth. To talk to us about the dam removal, joining us by phone, we have Senator Doug Whitsitt of Senate District 28, which encompasses Klamath County and a big chunk of southern Oregon. Needless to say, he's very knowledgeable about all of this. So, Senator, welcome. Thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
So tell us a little bit about Senate District 28. It's pretty big. It goes all the way up to Prineville, if I remember right?
Yes, it includes all of Klamath, Lake, and Crook counties, the eastern half of Deschutes County, and about a third of Jackson County.
Okay, and could you tell us a little bit about your background?
I'm a retired veterinarian. I grew up in Central Oregon on a little dairy, went to high school in Prineville, started college at the community college here in Bend, but it was actually on the campus of the high school at night, and went on to Washington State, came down here to Klamath Falls to spend a couple of years, kind of fell in love with the place, and just stayed here and practiced for 30 years.
So what got you into public service?
A fateful phone call one evening. Actually, we'd been quite involved in the water issues. My wife's a geologist, and we had spent quite a bit of time doing meetings and so forth on the water issues. And I made a call one evening to the sitting senator just to remind him to come to breakfast the next morning, and 3 days later, I'm a candidate for the Senate.
Well, let's get some background on all of this and kind of set the stage for the discussion today. What it comes down to is a conflict over water and land use, and so what we're talking about are four dams that are owned and operated by PacifiCorps, which were built over a period of years. So help us understand the nature of the dispute. On the one side, we've got farmers who need the water for crop irrigation, and it seems, if I remember correctly, it was back in 1917 or so when this really got going and when the feds wanted to open up the area to farming. So what was the original agreement then between the settlers and farmers regarding the Klamath Basin water?
Well, originally, about 1905, the Bureau of Reclamation set up the Klamath Project, withdrew most of the water rights that hadn't already been set up. And so most of the irrigators above the upper Klamath Lake have water rights that are not involved with the Klamath Project. So anyway, in 1905, they set up the Klamath Project. They drained what was used to be Tule Lake and the lower Klamath Lake and made a wildlife refuge down there. I think it was Teddy Roosevelt did that in about 1907 or something like that. They created Clear Lake, which is actually an evaporation pond to get rid of the water, and started building diversions. They had an agreement. Usually a Bureau of Reclamation project also has a electricity generation component, and actually the former COPCO negotiated with the United States government they would provide low-cost power for a period of time for the right to use the run of the river to generate electricity.
Yeah.
So the COPCO built the four dams on the river, and eventually they became PacifiCorps, and they provided low-cost power to the irrigators here in the basin for 100 years when they wanted to. About 1956, I believe it was, they wanted to build another dam, the J.C. Boyle Dam, and they renegotiated their contract, and so they extended the low-cost power. So in total, it was for 100 years. that ran out in 2006. Hmm. So the irrigation water part of it is really a man-made situation where they're starting to make rules and regulations where you can't divert the water. And the power part component of it occurred started really in earnest in 2006 when the low-cost power provision ran out.
So how necessary then are those dams for irrigation? I mean, can they pump water out of the ground instead?
The dams on the Klamath River are not relevant to the irrigation in the upper Klamath Basin. They're downstream, way downstream.
I see.
They are relevant to some of the irrigators in Siskiyou County that down on the Shasta Irrigation District, I believe, has a water right of about 60,000 acre feet on one of those reservoirs. Hmm. And obviously, if they drain the reservoir, there's no water for irrigation for them.
So I think what Klamath is really known for up here, I mean, at least when they've really made the news, was that big drought back in 2001. Up until then, were the salmon and fish in those rivers still plentiful?
No. There's been no salmon in the Klamath River, upper Klamath River, since the original Kopko Dam was built in 1918. And the suckerfish were quite plentiful. I don't believe they still are quite plentiful. Not as they once were, but there's even the scientists will agree there's lots of suckerfish. The suckerfish are older. They tend to spawn when they're pretty old, and so if you take a lot of the old spawners out, it takes them a while to come back. It's the water shortage in 2001 was man-made. At the time when the water was turned off to the project, I took a number of people on tours around the basin just to show them what was going on. And at that time, Upper Klamath Lake was absolutely full, which is the primary reservoir. It was lapping over the top.
Hmm.
So there wasn't, it was a redirection of the water. The water was been, it had been determined that the water needed to be kept in the lake for the suckerfish and it had needed to be running down the river for the coho salmon. And by those two biological opinions, if you served both biological opinions, there wasn't enough money water to do both, and so there was no water for irrigation.
Gotcha.
And we just ran completely afoul of the Endangered Species Act.
Okay. Senator, we do need to take a quick little break here. Don't go anywhere. We'll be back in a minute with Senator Doug Whitsitt. And welcome back to the I Spy on Salem Radio Show. We're here today with Senator Doug Whitsitt. We're talking about the Klamath Dam removal that's under debate right now down in southern Oregon. So, Senator, during the break, we were talking a little bit about the original water conditions, and you said some of the salmon haven't been there since the early 1900s in the one area, but you were talking, too, about what the settlers had actually found when they first got to that area. Can you talk to us about that?
Yes. If we read the journals of Williamson and Fremont and Applegate, some of the first people that came through and explored this country, they all had the same thing to say. The water was very, very poor quality. John C. Fremont was, when he came across the desert with no less than Kit Carson as his guide, he was afraid to water his livestock in Upper Klamath Lake because the water quality was so bad. And that was, I believe, before 1850. When the Applegate of the Applegate Trail, the Oregon Trail, actually took their trail up through Bear Valley and over down the Klamath River rather than coming around Upper Klamath Lake because he feared for the quality of water as well. And Williamson had several trips where he commented on the poor quality of the water. So the water has been here. It's a geological thing. Water has been poor here for a long time. It has virtually nothing to do with logging or farming.
Well, I guess that kind of brings us around then to the other side of the debate, which is that the other side would have us believe that if we do knock down these dams and do all this restoration, that we'll have these pristine areas for fish and all of that. So I guess my question here is, if these dams have been here for decades, why are they suddenly up in arms now?
I don't have an answer for you. I know that that's what the rhetoric is now. There's been a huge effort an agreement between 24 different entities, and those entities included two irrigation groups, two of nine counties. There was a whole raft of state and federal agencies, several Indian tribes, I think, 8 or 9 different environmental conservation groups in that group. And they started out with the idea that they were going to try to solve this ongoing litigation over whose water, you know, who had the right to the water, whether it's the irrigators who have a water right or whether it's the Fish or an Endangered Species Act litigation. And so they started out as a consensus group. And then somewhere along the line, they decided that they would shift that into, in the middle of the process, to a majority rule. And you can see how that came out, with the government agencies and the tribes and the environmental groups outnumbering the irrigation groups 12-1.
Right. Let's come back to that, but real quick, is there something in particular about these four dams that the environmental groups find so distasteful, or are they going after Klamath Fall, the Klamath farmers, just simply because they're lower income and can't afford multi-million-dollar lobbyists?
I think the if you look at the entire Klamath River Basin, it's a great test case. We have tribes at the bottom and tribes at the top. We have endangered species at the bottom and endangered species at the top. We have a reclamation project. We have national wildlife refuges, two of them, three of them, actually. And so it's, and there's only 124,000 people live in the entire Klamath River Basin, from the ocean all the way to the headwaters. So it's a test case. They would, their environmental community, and I believe some in government, really want to create a, to reestablish a free and wild running river from the headwaters of the ocean again.
Hmm.
And their idea is to strip everything out of it. And that's, I think, the thing, more than anything, driving this issue. And when it came down again to that negotiation group, we ended up with an agreement that was pressured to remove the dams as a means of trying to maintain irrigation water rights and the right to continue to do what we've been doing here for 100 years.
Well, so you started to talk about some of the agreements that were forged, and so let me kind of bring people up to speed on that. Back in February of 2010, there were two big agreements signed between federal, state, utility, and tribal officials, and you said, I think there's 24. I've seen a number that said there was as much as 30 groups involved in this, and these were the two agreements were the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement and the Klamath Basin Hydroelectric Agreement. And so basically, the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement, in a nutshell, it outlines how we're going to restore wild salmon populations and provide water supply certainty to communities and users. Is that how you see that agreement?
That's how it's been advertised and sold.
What do they mean by water supply certainty?
What they mean is a certain number of the project irrigators would receive most of the water or all of the water that they would normally get on a normal year, and some confidence that they would receive water in a dry year. The trade-off is that they would actually downsize the size of the project somewhat, and they would also trade off some water rights above the lake, and actually, in order to do that, you would have to dewater about 30,000 acres above Upper Klamath Lake, in those which is primarily cattle raising country, and actually the cattle industry is the second largest producer of agricultural income in the state of Oregon, and in Klamath County, it's far and away the largest producer.
Okay, and we've got about 45 seconds before the next break here. The hydroelectric agreement, as I understand it, this would have the process to develop studies and environmental reviews to inform. Make an informed decision about whether or not they can remove these dams, or whether it's, you know, necessary for restoration of fish, and is in the public interest. Is that also how you see that agreement?
Yes, there's actually three agreements. There are three different studies that have been done. That Camp Dresser McKee study was commissioned by the Bureau of Reclamation and Department of Interior, and they kind of decided that there was a lot of things that needed to be discussed that perhaps the government didn't want to discuss, so such as sediment and that sort of thing. So that that study sort of set on was covered up for a while, and the company that did it actually finally released it because I think they believed that the people needed to see it. And there was also a Federal Energy Regulatory Commission study done that concluded that the best thing to do would be to relicense the dams and improve fish passage.
Senator, let me interrupt right there. We need to take a quick break. Everyone stay with us. Be back in a minute. And just a little reminder, starting tomorrow is NFIB's annual Small Business Summit in Bend, Oregon. The summit starts at 5 p.m. with a reception and then gets underway 8 a.m. Monday and goes through Tuesday at noon. The summit is open to members and non-members, and you don't even have to be a business owner. The event is open to anyone interested in Oregon's economy, policies, and small business. At the summit, which will be held at the beautiful Sun River Resort, you'll have a chance to meet with other small business owners from all across the state and get some face-to-face time with state representatives and senators. You'll also meet Jonathan Williams, who wrote Rich States, Poor States, along with co-author Steve Moore and Arthur Laffer, the godfather of supply-side economics. If you don't know about NFIB, you should. NFIB has almost 7,000 members in Oregon and is growing fast. They're a strong advocate for business, and their challenge to Obamacare is now headed to the U.S. Supreme Court. And if you're going to the summit, look me up for a chance to get on the radio. We'll be interviewing attendees to get your opinion as business owners on what you think needs to change in the state to get people working again. Find out more about NFIB or the summit, go to nfib.com/Oregon or call 866-307-2846. That number again, 866-307-2846. And now, back to the show. And thanks for staying with us. We're here again today with Senator Doug Whitsitt, and we're talking Klamath Dam removal. And Senator, before the break there, you were talking about some studies that got kind of covered up, and that kind of leads me into something else here that I had found, was that there's an interesting little video on Southern Oregon Ag Online. That's Southern Oregon Ag Online. This was an interview with Tom Malams, and a few years back, they took off 100,000 acres off this irrigation project. The idea being was that they were going to increase the flow into the Klamath Basin, but it didn't work, and it actually shows that the water levels declined. But as he was talking in there, some of the things that came out was that this was, even though that this interstate agreement has been framed as being very cooperative and it had a consensus building, it turns out the Pacific Corps actually pulled out of the negotiations very, very early on because they realized that this was not at all about relicensing dams and it was going to happen whether they wanted to or not. And so this is, I think, real typical of how the left operates is they come in and they try to have this appearance of a consensus, but the reality is they've got all their stakeholders on their side, but on the other side, there's almost no representation. So is that how you see that too? Is that, even though that this has been framed as being very, having a lot of widespread support, did it have widespread support?
I believe that the opposition is probably 2-1 in that ballpark. I say that because in Siskiyou County, California, they actually put it on the ballot, and I think it was 73% of the people said they did not want the dams removed.
Wow.
Representative Bill Garrard and I commissioned a study that we paid for ourselves in the spring of 2009, where we asked 300 people across the basin, and this is done professionally, had a statistical confidence of 95%. We asked 300 people across the basin a series of questions, and one of those was about dam removal, and there was right at 70% of those people polled said, no, we don't want the dams taken out, period.
Hmm.
And then going on to the Pacific Corps part of it, there was an EP article written by Jeff Bernard when he was interviewing a Pacific Corps vice president named Dean Brockbank. And in that, as I recall that interview, Mr. Brockbank was saying that they were summoned back to West Virginia to talk about relicensing the dams and alternatives and so forth. And in that interview, it became apparent that in the first day that the Department of Interior and the states of Oregon and California had already decided they wanted the dams taken out. They thought it was going to be in the best public interest, and so Pacific Corps wasn't given the option, really, of relicensing the dams. What's your other alternative?
Yeah.
And I suppose In that situation, mine would have been the same as theirs, survival.
Yeah. Well, the other thing in that same interview, they actually tried to add some other irrigator groups and other water users, but they were actually denied a seat at the table. And what was interesting, though, is that there was a group that was representing about 5,000 acres, which is very small compared to their 120,000 and 200,000 acres. That group was welcomed because they advocated for dam removals, but then it later turned out that the head of that six-member group was actually on the payroll for Sustainable Northwest. So was there any real input from the Klamath communities? I mean, was this well-publicized public hearing meetings? Did they get input from hundreds, if not thousands, of people? I mean, talk to us about that a little bit.
We actually, in the fall of 2009, again, Representative Garrard and I held an all-afternoon and all-evening listening session at the fairgrounds, and once again, we paid for the fairgrounds and had the people come in. And there were several hundred people there. Of the 300 people who spoke at the microphone or who left written testimony, 300 out of 300 said no. Hmm. I need to put a little sideboard on that. The proponents of the dam removal and the KBRA may have boycotted that meeting.
Wow.
And getting back to the other, what they now call the upper Basin Irrigation Group, or whatever they call it, that's essentially, since the off-project irrigators have been and continue to be major opponents of this situation, the proponents put together a small group of people who do actually irrigate in the upper basin and who are... some of them are affiliated with the Sustainable Northwest, and some of them have really junior water rights. And in any case, there are a group up there that are saying, yes, we want this thing. They're outnumbered hugely.
Hmm. Well, in terms of the process then, do you feel that those, you know, whether we're talking about this dam removal or just as what you see as a state senator, do you feel that those in either elected positions or who run departments that are conducting these types of public hearings, whether it's the Department of the Interior or California Department of Fish and Wildlife, or who otherwise have oversight, actually want that public input and will, in fact, stop this if the majority of the public is against it, or are they merely going through the motions and will do it anyway?
I think they're mainly going through the motions. I have not witnessed this personally, but I have neighbors who have attended some of these public input meetings, and the common denominator seems to be that no one is recording the meeting and no one is taking notes, which doesn't give you a great deal of comfort that they're listening very closely.
No, it doesn't. So leading up to the February...
And then the other thing I want to point out, in these negotiations, Mark, these were closed meetings. They were closed to the press. They were closed to the public. They were closed to elected officials.
Wow.
There was no way you could get in them. And in addition to that, they had a... confidentiality agreement you had to sign before you could go in. It said two things: you won't discuss it, you know, you won't discuss anything that was said here, and the second thing is that you will agree to the outcome no matter what it is.
Oh my word. So much for that whole idea of transparency in government. You know, let's go ahead and take a little break right here, and everybody stay with us. We'll be back in another minute. And thanks for staying with us. We're here today with Senator Doug Whitsitt out of Senate District 28, and we're talking the Klamath Dam removal. So let's talk real quick about whether there's any truth to some of the statements that the dam removal proponents are claiming. For example, one of the things that I found on their website is that the mere existence of dams kills fish. What are your thoughts on that?
No. The dams block upward migration of salmon at Iron Gate Dam. But the Iron Gate hatchery was built to mitigate that blockage and produces about 5 million salmon smolts each year.
Hmm. And then they also claim that dams create toxic blooms of algae that is thousands of times higher than what the World Health Organization says is safe to ingest. What are your thoughts on that one?
Toxic blooms have occurred resulting from algae-laden water running downstream from Klamath Lake, where blue-green algae is, always has, and always will be a severe water quality problem. But Upper Klamath Lake is widely used for fishing, is world-renowned for its red-band trout, sailing, water skiing, and other water sports, and several of the reservoirs down the river have been used for that way for the last 50 years.
Hmm. They also claim that the Klamath River salmon, their numbers are now so dangerously low that they're close to extinction, and they actually had to shut down commercial fishing along the coast. What are your thoughts on that, that the fish are near extinction?
I think that the number of fish in the rivers has more to do with ocean conditions and the Pacific Oscillation than it does, the Cape Oscillation, than it does with terrestrial conditions. But to specifically answer your question, it's my understanding that this year we have one of the largest runs of Klamath River salmon ever recorded.
Yeah, isn't that a little inconvenient fact? Also, what do you think about their claim that dams destroy habitat because it blocks the natural functions of rivers by not flushing out fish parasites and whatnot?
The dams do block upstream migration, no question about that. and they do modulate the flow so you don't get the big flooding issues that used to decimate the lower river, but it also doesn't scour out the banks and the gravel beds the way it used to.
Good point.
Once again, that was the purpose and the foresight of building the Iron Gate fish hatchery.
The other claim is that the turbines on the dam can only operate at less than half capacity and generate, in fact, only 2% of Pacific Core's overall power, so these aren't even necessary. What are your thoughts on that?
They only work at half capacity because, for several reasons. One is all the water quality rules that they have. Second is fish mitigation rules that they have. It's not that they can't run the turbines at full bore. They're not allowed to. And secondly, the biggest feature of those, as I understand it, those turbines on the Klamath River is their peaking ability. You can turn them on almost immediately and turn them off almost immediately. So when you have a lot of solar power or wind power, if the wind stops blowing and the sun stops shining, you have to be able to mitigate that in a hurry. And that it's not only their ability to do that, but it's their location right in the middle of the grid that makes them so valuable.
Mm. Okay, let's maybe turn to some of the costs of all of this. What is the total all cost of this proposed to be for the dam removal, new power generation, habitat restoration? I saw something like $1.5 billion. Frankly, that seems a tad low.
It probably is low. It kind of comes again back to the sediment thing. I think we're going to talk about that later. But it depends on what you do in the form of restoration and how much the electricity costs to replace it. We know that hydropower currently costs about $86 a kilowatt hour to produce and a megawatt hour to produce, and solar is about $211. So if we're going to replace those dams' production with solar, and wind is in the ballpark of solar, it's going to cost about at least three times as much to replace the power that is currently being produced. And that power is currently being produced without creating any greenhouse gases whatsoever.
Right.
And we think that if you replace those with a, say, a gas-fired plant or a coal-fired plant, the tonnage of carbon dioxide that would be produced is, you know, if that bothers you, that the tonnage of carbon dioxide will be huge to replace them.
Yep. Well, so let's say that we move forward with dam removal. All that water, of course, is going to be washed out to sea. But then there's also decades worth of silt that you've alluded to, and that's all piled up over the years. Do they have any idea about how much silt is back there?
That Camp Dresser McGee report used about 20 million cubic yards, and they, in at least two different places in that report, suggest that they believe that estimate is really low. But if it's 2 million cubic yards, that's 20 million cubic yards, that is 2 million, equal to 2 million 10-yard dump trucks full of sand and silt and muck. And if you were to line those up head to tail, they would reach from Los Angeles to New York to Los Angeles to New York and about halfway back again.
Yes.
And we're somehow being told that dumping that much sediment into the river isn't going to harm the river. But we're ruling recreational miners out of the river because they're stirring up sediment.
Yeah.
And we're ruling people off the farm ground because they're saying that you're running too much sediment in the river. We're not allowed to build logging roads because of that same reason, and
yes,
all kinds of mitigation to keep the sediment going in. And we're
going to
dump
point.
A million dump truck loads, and then, you know, I mean, come on.
Well, so all that silt there, I mean, what do the dam removal proponents suggest we do with that? Are they thinking we got to just truck it all out or just let nature flush it out?
Well, actually, Mark, they're just the I've only read the draft. I mean, the 50 or 60 page draft of the draft environmental impact statement, or the summary. The EIS is like 2,000 or 2,500 pages long. But as near as I can tell, their plan is to just simply blow the dams and let it run down the river.
Wow.
And even if even only half that much goes down the river, it's an incredible amount. Oh. And if you want to talk to some of the folks over on the Rogue River, where they've taken out the Savage Rapids Dam and the Gold Ray Dams, which are really, really, really small dams compared to these dams, they'll tell you that there's a lot of damage. In fact, I just read an article a couple of days ago where they allege the river is really sick.
Wow. You know, actually, let's go ahead and take a little break right there. We need to actually pay for our segment, so everybody stay with us. We'll be right back.
And one quick announcement before we officially go to break. Trevor Loudon will be speaking at the Salem 912 Project General Meeting, which is at the Scottish Rite Temple on South Commercial Street in Salem on Friday, October 14th from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. You know, America, despite the damage the Obama administration has done, is still seen as a beacon of hope and freedom by people in other countries all around the world. Trevor Loudon, who lives in New Zealand, is one such person. Trevor is a libertarian activist, a researcher, and has written an upcoming book, Barack Obama and the Enemy Within, about the Obama administration, and it also focuses on unlocking the covert side of U.S. and global politics. For more details, head to 912projectsalem.com. Again, that's Friday, October 14th from 6:30 to 8:30 at the Scottish Rite Temple on Southeast Commercial, and that website is 912projectsalem.com.
And thanks for staying with us. We're here again talking about the Klamath Dam removal. And so, Senator Whitsitt, you know, as I'm sitting here listening to all this, I can't help but think that the vast benefits of removing these dams is only going to add to the diverse economy that Oregon is now enjoying since we've decided to end logging on public lands to protect a few spotted owls. We've already talked a little bit about the costs on this, and one of the things that that we didn't touch on was in terms of how this would interrupt, you know, that's just the hard costs of dam removal and whatnot, but we haven't really talked about the economic impact of all this, and according to an OSU Extension economic study, the land served by the Tule Lake Irrigation District in Klamath County, the agriculture there contributes over $600 million to the economy annually and supports close to 5,000 jobs directly. So removing these dams, is that going to impact those at all?
It probably won't directly impact those in the Tule Lake Irrigation District. And most of the Tule Lake Irrigation District is in Tule Lake, which is in California, not Oregon. But the big impact is going to be in the dewatering of 30,000 acres above the lake. And that's some of the best cattle grazing country in the world. I mean, particularly Fort Klamath and part of the Spread River country, it's just amazing the gains you get on that grass. But you don't have grass without the water.
Right.
So it's been a trade-off. I mean, they're going to, and that's one of the reasons why there are so many people upset, particularly the irrigators, is that many of the people whose water would be traded off really didn't feel like they were represented in the negotiations.
Well, you know, the Cattlemen's Association, we had one of their representatives on quite a while ago, and as we talked with him and with Carla K. Edwards and some of the public land use issues that we've talked about over the last 7 or 8 months or so, the cattlemen really seem to be coming under a lot of fire, and they really want to remove cattle rights from public land use and stuff. Are you seeing a lot of that down there as well?
I would say, you know, I'm a large animal veterinarian. I'm retired, but of the accounts that we used to serve, and we used to serve most of the accounts in the basin, I would say that cattle numbers are down by 40%. And the last time I looked, the last information I saw on the national cattle herd was down to about 1956 levels.
Mm.
That's one of the reasons why the price of beef is up so high.
I was just going to say that.
And you're seeing cattlemen being moved off of rangeland. You're finding cattlemen that are finding it more and more difficult to maintain their home ranches. When I first went into veterinary practice in 1968, most of the people that I worked for spent their time actually raising cattle and farming. Now they're spending a half to two-thirds of the time going to meetings and legislative hearings and so forth, trying to preserve the right to continue to make a living.
Hmm. So back to that extension study there that says that that area adds $600 million to the local economy and has 5,000 direct and indirect jobs from farming. What are the on the other side of things, what are the conservationists predicting that by having these wild salmon and whitewater, what is that going to add to the economy?
Well, first of all, the whitewater rafting on the Klamath River, for the most part, is a function of the dams. They turn water loose so you can raft in the river. If you don't have those dams to regulate the flow, there will be very few days when you can raft the river.
Wow.
Then the
that's amazing because there's a lot of whitewater rafting.
The fishery, I can't imagine having a viable commercial or sport salmon fishery up in the upper basin here. We're at 4,100 feet. By the time the salmon have migrated all the way up, if they get this far, through some of the really poor water quality and so forth, and up 4,100 feet, or you know, the likelihood of them being very shiny and bright and good eating is slim and none. But I mean, it's not something that is going to. We can't trade agriculture for salmon, and the fishery is. You know, we're not going to trade agriculture for people coming to fish if the fish are not here or are hardly edible if they are here.
Right. Have they done any studies in terms of the recreational impact? Then are they citing any numbers?
I haven't seen the numbers. I'm sure that I've heard in meetings that we've gone to where. They're touting the new fishery and all that will bring to the basin. I just don't see that happening.
Hmm.
And even, you know, I mean, it's they're talking about the salmon spawning above Upper Klamath Lake. Upper Klamath Lake in the summertime is, you know, in the high 70s and low 80s degree temperature. It's really kind of a blue-green color from the algae. Looks a little more like soup than water. If you look at it closely, it's not habitat that salmon are going to. I'm not a fish biologist, but I mean, I just intuitively you can look at that water. So you know, fish aren't going to do well, or salmon aren't going to do well. The big red band trout, I've learned, you know, they stay in the lake in the wintertime. They go up Wood River and Seven Mile River and Williamson River and Spring Creek, so the fishing up there is really good in the late spring and throughout the summer. And then they come back into the lake and spawn and what have you. So, I mean, you know, they've learned to adapt to it, but I don't see the salmon migrating through that lake.
No. Real quick here, we got about 30 seconds. In a news release back in 2003, in response to a federal judge rejecting the Bush administration's plan, at that time they were saying that by rejecting it, the decision gives hopes to the families that depend on the Klamath River salmon, and that the case was about restoring balance to the basin so that fishermen, Native Americans, and irrigators can all receive a fair share of the water. So are the farmers there getting their fair share, in your opinion?
Yes, they have been, except for 2001, when the water was turned off. And again, last year, they were greatly curtailed. It was a dry year. And there are years, in this, you know, the Upper Klamath Basin is a desert valley. We have a lot of snowfall in the Huron Crater Lake. We have a lot of runoff, and we, you know, by storing that in Upper Klamath Lake and in other reservoirs, we have a lot of water. There are dry years when things are going to be difficult, and they've always been difficult in dry years.
Okay, all right. Let me interrupt you there. We need to take a quick break. Everyone stay with us. And thanks for staying with us. We're into our final segment now with Senator Doug Whitsitt, and we're talking the Klamath Dam removal. So one of the things that I came across in my research for this is that one thing that is never talked about by the proponents of all of this is that one of the reasons that the Klamath River is so low is because much of the water is actually diverted into two California rivers that are then used for irrigation. So if they remove these dams, are they going to, I mean, if that's what the concern about is restoring river levels, are they going to then stop diverting that water?
The water that's diverted from the Klamath River Basin to California comes out of the Trinity River, and that is a tributary of the Klamath that comes in. I think it's less than 50 miles from the mouth of the Klamath River. So, to the extent that the water is diverted from the upper part of the Trinity into Whiskeytown Lake and over on into the Sacramento Valley, then the the water needs to be made up from the upper basin coming on down the rest of the river. But the actual diversion to California is out of the Trinity, which is a major tributary to the Klamath, but way down the valley.
Okay, so that's further down below those then. Okay, thanks for clearing that up. So what's it going to cost then to replace the power that's currently generated? Do they have any thoughts on that?
Well, again, to quantify it, somebody's got to have a sharper pencil than I do, but if we're going to replace that power with renewable energy, then is probably going to be at least three times as more expensive than it currently is.
And so when they were selling this to the public, I'm sure they publicized that to everybody, that your rates may go up three times.
I can't see any way, if you're going to replace it with solar or wind power, it costs at least three times as much to generate. That's just a fact.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't see anywhere in their marketing materials that kind of was, you know, bold-faced or anything like that. So according to the agreement, then the Department of the Interior is going to they have this environmental impact study that just came out, I think actually last week or so. Do you have any idea who wrote that impact study? Have you had a chance to look at that at all?
I have read the executive summary, which is about 60 pages, and I've read the news releases. The environmental impact statement, the draft statement itself, is well south of 2,000 pages, and I haven't had time to dive through that whole thing. And I don't have a lot of trust in executive summaries, and I not just from this particular. I've read a lot of environmental impact statements, and they tend to cherry pick what they want you to hear in the executive summary, and you know the things that you want to find are on page 687 in the lower left-hand corner. That got you.
So
I mean, it takes it does take a lot of time and effort to go through those things and actually find out what is being said and what is being suggested that we should do.
And
as far as the total costs go, I think you know, they're talking about $1 million or $1 billion for the restoration agreement, probably another $500 million to take the dams out. If they're going to do anything to really mitigate the sediment, we're probably looking at several hundred million to the highest. I think the highest I've seen is the estimate on that is well more than $2.5 billion.
Mm.
If you were going to actually take the sediment out and put it someplace and let it dry out and store it, to put a price tag on it, it's a nebulous thing.
Mm.
But we know it's going to be expensive, and the question is, why are we doing it?
Yeah. Well, that's kind of where I was thinking that too. While you're talking about that, is that, you know, with all of that money, you're talking billions of dollars. Why can't the state just, you know, maybe dangle a $100 million prize to some inventor that comes up with a new and better way to get fish upstream? It'd be a lot cheaper.
Well, I think if you look, you'll find that historically there never really has been a salmon fishery in the Upper Klamath Basin. There are anecdotes where they found salmon at Keno, and there were anecdotes when the tribal fishers talk about their salmon. But again, the explorers up here never saw any salmon, and the question that begs answering is, if we had all these salmon up here, why are the sucker fish considered staple rations for the tribes, and why are they considered holy fish? Because if you ever tried to eat a sucker, a salmon's a lot better, let me tell you.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit real quick about some solutions. We've got about a minute and a half or so left here. What are some things that people can be doing, and is this process a foregone conclusion, or is it something that can be stopped yet?
You know, I don't think it's a foregone conclusion, and this is a government of the people, and the people need to get engaged, need to get to take some time to learn the issues, and then call your congressman, email your congressman, write him a letter. Neither of these agreements can be implemented without both congressional bills that authorize them and also a bill in the state of California and a bill in the state of Oregon.
And which congressman in particular should they be talking to?
So the congressman specifically, I mean, there are two senators, Wyden and Merkley, and Senator Merkley is the one who has actually written the draft bill, which is a draft discussion bill, which would implement the both of those agreements in Congress. Senator Wyden is his his counterpart. Congressman Walden in Oregon and Congressman Herger in California represent virtually the entire area of the Klamath Basin.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much for joining us this week, Senator Whitsitt. I think we definitely need to have you back. This is a pretty complicated issue. And thank you, everyone, for joining us today. And we will see you next week on the I Spy on Salem radio show. Reagan, take us out.
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's not just a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy on Salem Radio Show.